It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. ProPublica released another bombshell report last month detailing the interconnectedness of drug companies and the Food and Drug Administration, which is ostensibly charged with approving the drugs that come to market. The report by Caroline Chen details how some drugs fast-tracked by the FDA have ended up doing more harm to patients than good. Chen notes that the part of the FDA that reviews drugs before they go to market is largely funded by Big Pharma. And she points out doctors who prescribe these drugs are often on Big Pharma's payroll, too. We're talking this hour with Caroline Chen of ProPublica. Caroline, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how did you come to this story? What made you want to do this?
I actually had received a tip about a specific drug, which is in the story. It's called Nuplazid. It's a Parkinson's disease psychosis treatment. And somebody had pointed out that there had been a lot of reports about patients having bad side effects after it had been approved. And so I just started looking at the drug, you know, started talking to patients. And as I started to look at the history of the drug and how it got approved in the first place, I started to have a lot of questions. In particular, with this drug, it had actually failed two clinical trials, and by that it means it doesn't show more benefit than a placebo. And then the drug company reworked the trial, changed the measurement scale they were using, and then they had one positive trial.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the medical reviewers at the FDA at the time actually said, we shouldn't approve this drug because there were a lot of bad side effects, and there was a higher death rate, actually, in the drug arm. And he said there's very little benefit coming from this drug. And he felt like the risks outweighed the benefit. And at the end of the day, he was overruled by his boss, and the FDA did approve the drug. And so starting with that one drug...
And what happened with that one drug? Can I just say what happened with that?
So it's approved. It's on the market. And the FDA collects what's called adverse events reports, which is reports of bad side effects or bad outcomes on the drug. And since being on the market for about 2 years, there have been 6,800 reports of bad side effects for patients on the drug, including 887 deaths. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that the drug is responsible in every case, because you can't really tell from the reports, but it's a very high number of reports just compared to, you know, typically when you see other drugs go on the market, you don't get this sort of number. So I would say there's a serious red flag that's been raised now. And so starting with that drug, I started looking at the FDA.
Okay, so here my question here is that this drug is for a specific and rare disease, correct?
It's a pretty rare condition in that, you know, it's a subset of patients who have Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm. And this is for people with Parkinson's disease who have hallucinations, really bad hallucinations, correct?
Yeah, it's called Parkinson's disease psychosis, so that can mean hallucinations. You're seeing things that aren't there, or delusions, you know, where they think they're not at home. They're confused about where they are. They think that there are other people in the room.
So my question is, I guess what I'm getting to here is that the adverse side effects and the increased deaths, 800 people dying, could that be because of the disease, not just because of the treatment?
Yes, certainly you could ask that question. And these patients are older and tend to be more fragile by the time they get psychosis. However, what we did see in the trials was a higher rate of death and some pretty serious side effects in the patients who had been on the drug arm. So I guess what happened here is that there is a drug that has a sort of concerning signal and had someone at the FDA say we shouldn't approve the drug, then it goes on the market, and now we have all these questions. So as I said, a lot of adverse events reports, we can't prove that the drug is responsible for every one of those cases.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you have a situation here, which is what I'm finding concerning, is when you fast-track a drug, and this drug was fast-tracked, you can end up in a situation where you have more questions than answers about the drug once it goes on the market. And patients are left now in the situation where they're like, well, is it actually safe for me to take?
Right.
Should I take it?
Right.
What do all of these reports mean? And there's actually just not a lot of information about the treatment because there you know, only one trial was done instead of two for approval.
So you detailed in your report one man who had hallucinations. The drug Nuplazid actually made his hallucinations worse. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so I talked to the wife of a Parkinson's patient in California, and he had started to get hallucinations about 5 years ago, and they didn't do anything about it because they were pretty benign. You know, he would see cats and dogs around the house, but he wasn't really bothered by them. And then his name is Terrence Miller. So, and then Terrence had a hip surgery. His hallucinations started getting worse, and so his doctor prescribed Nuplazid to him. And he tried Nuplazid, and his hallucinations started getting a lot darker, is what his wife said. And his wife said, you know, she would start to feel afraid because her husband was saying, oh, like, they're telling me to do bad stuff. And that totally freaked her out. And so they stopped Nuplazid, and they switched doctors as well. And eventually he's been put on a different drug, which seems to be helping him.
And the doctor that prescribed Nuplazid to begin with, was that doctor connected to the pharmaceutical company that put out the drug?
Yeah, so one thing that that neither Terrence nor his wife knew at the time is Dr. Brillman, who is his doctor, actually has been paid quite a lot in consulting fees from the drug company, which is called Acadia. She was the seventh highest paid doctor by Acadia in 2016. They gave her about $14,500 in consulting fees.
So is this usual that drug companies pay doctors in consulting fees and then those doctors prescribe these experimental drugs to their patients?
Yeah, it's pretty typical in the industry, actually, particularly for what's known as specialty drugs. So it's, I would say, maybe a little less common for sort of the run-of-the-mill cholesterol drugs, but typically when a drug is new, when the company is trying to get it on the market, when there might be a pretty specialized population where there is a limited number of doctors that would be prescribing it, there often, and you can see this if you go on ProPublica's website, we have a database called Dollars for Docs, which takes data from the government, and you can put in your doctor's name, or you can put in a company name, or you can put in through a company name, you can look for a drug, a specific drug, and find out what's being paid. And I think what we've seen in sort of studies that have been done by academics before is that even if a doctor thinks they're totally neutral and they think, you know, I'm not influenced by industry money, they do end up prescribing more of the drug when they are being paid for consulting or for research from a drug company. It does tend to correlate with higher prescribing.
It may not have anything to do with money. It may be with the relationships with that drug company or the drug rep from that company who comes in all the time and talks to them. I have a question here that this number just blew me away. 75% of the FDA scientific reviews, their review panel is funded by drug companies. Where did you get that number? And talk to me about how that affects what the FDA reviews.
Yeah, so the number is actually 75% of the FDA's drug review budget, not the panels. We can talk about the panels later. That's a really interesting aspect as well.
Okay.
So these numbers come directly from the FDA. And what happened, to give you a little bit of history here, is around the AIDS crisis, the FDA actually had been very, very slow to review drugs. And I think we all agree that we don't want the FDA to take forever to review a drug that could be really good. And so a lot of HIV activists at the time said, you know, you got to speed up drug reviews. There are people dying. You know, you can't take, you know, a year to review a drug. And the FDA said, well, we're really understaffed and really under-resourced, and we can't move any faster. And so in 1992, Congress passed a piece of legislation where they said, you know, we're going to, besides taxpayer money, we're also going to take some funding from the industry. And basically, a drug company, every time it applies for a new drug to be reviewed, it pays a certain fee to the FDA. And that money goes directly to the budget of the folks who review the drugs. And that started out as being 27% of the whole budget in 1993, and now it's 75%, which is about $905 million. So the majority of the budget that goes to reviewing drugs, so this is paying for staff salaries, comes from pharma today. And in that same piece of legislation, they then wrote in some guarantees from the FDA. So they said, we will review drugs within 10 months of the application for a normal drug application and for a priority drug within 6 months. So they started to have some sort of time guarantees given back to the industry.
We are talking to Caroline Chen, who wrote a piece in ProPublica about how the drug industry is fast-tracking drugs that might not be safe. We're going to come back and talk about how that time change from the law in 1992 has affected us today. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump has arrived at NATO headquarters for today's summit in Brussels. The president is expected to repeat his call for some NATO members to raise their military budgets. Beijing is describing as totally unacceptable the Trump administration's threat to impose new tariffs on billions of dollars worth of Chinese goods. Here's NPR's Rob Schmitz.
China's Ministry of Commerce said it was shocked by the further threat of tariffs and it promised countermeasures against the U.S. economy. In a statement, Beijing said it calls on the international community to work with China to oppose the U.S. The Trump administration escalated its trade dispute with China on Tuesday, saying it would impose tariffs on roughly $200 billion worth of Chinese fish, petroleum, handbags, and textiles if Beijing does not change its trade practices.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski is one of several Republicans considered a potential swing vote on President Trump's nomination of federal judge Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. Elizabeth Arnold reports from Anchorage.
She's a moderate with a safe seat, and she can argue that she hasn't been afraid to buck President Trump on other issues, such as health care. Her tendency in these situations is to hang tough and bargain with the administration and other senators for something else she wants in her home state, which she did recently with her vote for the budget. In the end, it was a victory for her because it included opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 6:20. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A poll sponsored by a U.S.-Canadian agency finds a slight majority of the region's residents want more regulations to protect the Great Lakes. The survey by the International Joint Commission, or IJC, also finds most would be willing to pay more money for some consumer products if the lakes would be better protected. Mark Mattson of the IJC's Water Quality Board says the results are good news.
The figures reaffirm that those polled hold the lakes and their health in high regard, especially if they're willing to pay more personally to ensure their protection.
The poll was conducted earlier this year and surveyed more than 4,000 people around the Great Lakes region. About 300 were from Wisconsin. The number of people wanting more regulations rose 7 percentage points from an IJC poll done 3 years ago. A Wisconsin woman is accused of locking her 3-year-old daughter in a car during a heat wave while she was fishing with a friend. 24-year-old Jessica Jorgensen of West Allis was charged with felony child neglect. She posted $250 cash bond Monday. According to the complaint, a passerby's dogs heard the girl's cries from a car shortly before 5:30 in the morning, June 30th, in Franklin. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports police were able to unlock the car. The girl was flushed, sweaty, and alert. Jorgensen's attorney says his client will plead not guilty at her arraignment tomorrow. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News.
It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about a report from ProPublica detailing the relationship between Big Pharma and the FDA, specifically in the area of fast-tracking drugs. ProPublica's Caroline Chen wrote the piece, and she is with us today. We're also taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. What do you think about fast-tracking drugs? Do you think that drugs that are for specific rare diseases should go to market more quickly than other drugs? Caroline Chen, when we left off, we were talking about the fact that Congress passed a law in 1992 to fast-track drugs and got industry to kind of you know, put a little a skin in the game there, but that skin sort of grew to be kind of taking over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you had asked is sort of how does that influence the relationship? And I think the concern that I've heard from a lot of people is that then instead of having sort of a regulator and a regulated industry, you have more of a partnership, and it's that the FDA has become more industry friendly. And as I was reporting, I think the most concerning part of my reporting to me was talking to some former employees at the FDA who said that there was sort of this subtle push within the agency for approval. So one thing that was said to me by a former staffer was, you know, when we drugs get approved, we get congratulated. They would get congratulatory emails, but nobody gets congratulated when they turn down a drug. And you sometimes even get questioned.
And when you turn down a drug, it may be because it kills people. Like, you may be saving lives when you turn down a drug.
Yeah, or even sometimes it's a little more subtle than that, where they just think it's the benefit is not bigger than the risk that it brings to patients, even if it's not, you know, outright killing them. And so I think, you know, a bunch of the staffers I talked to, former staffers, just said, you know, there's sort of subtle pressure and sort of the messaging they get from their superiors is that you got to move quickly and that they're pro-industry.
So how do drug companies actually benefit from this?
Well, I think obviously getting a drug approved is always good. But the other thing that is, I think, a more subtle trade-off but really key here is the notion of speed. So the FDA over time has introduced at least four pathways that would help you sort of bypass what's the traditional requirement. So traditionally, you need at least two final stage phase three trials that prove a drug's benefit. So more drugs are being allowed to go out now with just one trial. So that was the case for Nuplazid. They also have this pathway called accelerated approval. And what that means is that you can show a difference in a marker or some measurement that they think correlates with you living better or living longer. So one example would be showing that a drug shrinks a tumor. Now, it sounds really good when your cancer tumor shrinks, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to live longer. So they have seen examples in the past before where tumors shrank, but then they came back even faster, and ultimately patients didn't live longer. And so more and more drugs are being approved on, these are called surrogate measurements or surrogate markers. More and more drugs are being allowed to be approved on a surrogate marker when we don't really, really know yet if a drug actually helps the patient live better or live longer.
The drug actually does something, but we don't know if it actually cures or makes the patient healthier. I find this interesting that science, it seems to be trumped by expediency. And in your piece, you talked about one company that the head of the FDA, the head of that department said, hey, if we don't approve this drug, that company is going to go out of business.
Yeah. So this was a drug for a pretty rare muscle disorder called Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And in 2016, it's a pretty rare disease, so understandably, it is hard to recruit patients. So in 2016, the drug company Sarepta had recruited some patients, and the only trial that they did, which compared the drug to a placebo, only had 12 patients in it. So it's a very, very small trial. And this used actually what we were just talking about, a surrogate marker. So they showed that the drug helped produce a small amount of the protein that the patients were missing. But they didn't prove that, you know, producing a little more of that protein would actually help the patient, you know, walk better or breathe better, you know, or have that's called a clinical benefit, an actual change to their experience of the disease. And at the time, a memo written by the chief scientist noted that Dr. Woodcock, who is the head of the drug review division, said that the company needed to be capitalized and might go under if they rejected the drug. And a lot of people argue that the FDA shouldn't worry about that. That shouldn't be the FDA's concern, whether or not a company is financially solvent or not. But it clearly was one of the factors in her mind.
Interesting, though, the other side of that is that if this is the only drug company that is studying and making drugs for this rare disease, and it puts all its money up there and it goes under, then who's going to focus on this disease?
Absolutely. And I think that this is a very valid concern. And I think that it's not just pharma who wants their drugs approved. I think there are a lot of patients who are very desperate, who are saying, you know, we want to take the chance, even if there is, you know, just a little protein that's produced and you can't actually tell me that it helps me live longer or walk better, I still want to try it. So there are certainly people who say, you know, keep using the accelerated pathways. But then I think the question is, do we as society understand the trade-off we're making, that more speed often means more uncertainty and less information? And then, you know, we haven't even talked about price yet, but this drug went on the market at a price of about $300,000 a year. So then the question is that an appropriate price for the level of certainty we get about its actual benefit?
Prices in general, you know, Pfizer has just decided to not raise prices as it had intended to do, as it started to do July 1st, because the president said, don't raise prices. So this is a pharmaceutical industry issue in general. But are these specialty drugs even more pricey? And isn't that sort of like unfair? You know, somebody's sick and they're going to charge them $5,000 per dose?
Well, I mean, there are arguments on both sides, right? So the argument from the pharma industry will be, if you don't give us a return on investment, then we can go and work on cholesterol, where everybody has high cholesterol. You know, why should we go work on your very rare disease where there are only 100 people if you're not going to let us charge prices where we can actually recoup our investment? So I do actually think that that is a very valid argument on the side of the drug industry, but I think if we're going to lower the bar for approval, so in one of the drugs that I used in my story, there's a cancer drug called Filovin. It was approved in 2009 on the basis of tumor shrinkage in about a third of the patients that got it. But they promised at the time of approval, we'll do the actual study to prove that it helps you live longer. It's now 2018. It's almost 10 years later. They still haven't finished their study. And it's a massively expensive drug. It's $92,000 for a course of treatment, and a patient might end up getting a number of courses of treatment. So the question is that worth it, you know, when we don't actually know whether it helps patients live longer?
So this, what's interesting to me is that there's not any investment from a higher level, from a governmental point of view, into these kinds of drugs. There's no sort of investment pot or investment fund, and the drug companies are having to figure this out themselves, and then the patient pays for it.
Yeah. I mean, I think our system, what is tough is ultimately that the patient often bears a large amount of the price, especially now that more and more people have high deductible insurance plans. So whereas in the past, maybe insurance would cover more of this and a patient would be shielded, I do think that the reality in the U.S. today is that patients are more and more exposed to the price of these drugs.
So what are the rules in other countries, in Canada and in European countries?
So the EU usually makes a decision as a bloc through the European Medicines Agency, and they do have a lot of similar programs. They do have, you know, their equivalent fast-track programs. But what we've seen over time is that the U.S. is now, you know, remember back in the history was that it was really slow during the HIV crisis, mm-hmm. which sort of spurred this speeding. Now the FDA is, in fact, the fastest drug agency, both in terms of the number of drugs that it reviews per year and approves per year, and also the amount of time it takes to approve the drugs. So compared to the European Medicines Agency, it's approving drugs, I think, about 60 days faster on average. So the review times are shorter. And in fact, some of the drugs that I have as examples in my story were turned down by the EMA. So the Duchenne muscular dystrophy drug we just talked about, the EMA said, there's not enough evidence that this actually benefits patients, so we're going to say no.
We are talking to Caroline Chen of ProPublica. She wrote a story about how drug companies and pharmaceutical companies are kind of intertwined in a way that nobody expected when they started fast-tracking drug approvals. We are taking your calls on this. Do you think that fast-tracking is good in some cases where People may die anyway. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. The drug companies and medical device companies, they pay physicians' fees. They get money from patients. Where do the insurance companies play in this?
Well, the insurance companies are currently, I would say, engaged in a head-on battle with the pharma companies. And it's interesting because I think everybody agrees that prices of drugs are rising and it's unsustainable and patients are really the ones being hurt here. But if you talk to the insurance companies, they'll say, it's the pharma company's fault. You know, they shouldn't price their drugs so high. And you talk to the pharma companies and they say it's the insurance company's fault. They're supposed to cover these drugs. So I think right now what we actually have in the U.S. is a lot of finger pointing and a lot of blaming going on where everybody says it's each other's problem. And that is honestly really unhelpful to patients because ultimately patients end up holding the bill.
So was this the same under Obama as it is under Trump? I mean, you know, there's a new FDA administrator. Is this changing now, or has this always been the same way in the last 15 years or so?
I would say it's an accelerating trend. So certainly under the Obama administration, the use of accelerated approval pathways and sort of a bent towards, you know, allowing companies to go out on the market with drugs under these pathways was already underway. What we have seen, though, is that President Trump has urged the current commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, to speed things up even more. So at one of the events, he was talking to Scott Gottlieb, and he said, you know, how long does it take to bring drugs to market? You're bringing that down, right? He said to Scott Gottlieb, and he said, and encouraged him to sort of keep up this trend. And what we have seen is that Scott Gottlieb has, in fact, announced a few more programs that would, again, allow companies to use surrogate measurements, sort of an easier pathway to market. So I think it will just keep continuing.
We are talking to Caroline Chen of ProPublica about drug manufacturing and getting fast-tracking drugs to market, especially for a specialty for rare diseases. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234, and we have Jim here in Fitchburg. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I question the standard that the FDA has in approving drugs that all the drug has to prove in the test, the double-blind study or whatever they use, if they can beat the placebo standard, which they know is 20%, they can get approval. And then that drug can be used for absolutely anything, from rubbing on your feet for a problem that is a superficial thing on skin, or any other ingesting internally, makes no difference. If they can beat the placebo 20%, they have a drug that the government will approve.
And you're saying that 20% is too low?
I'm saying that the 20% placebo standard is very low, but that is all that they have to beat, is that 20%, and they've got approval.
Caroline Chen, do you have an answer to that?
I actually think the standard varies a little bit depending on what the drug is, because the agency will talk to the drug maker and determine a standard. So I would say, yeah, for the most part, there are placebo-controlled trials, but sometimes the FDA does require comparison to what's called standard of care. So they'll say, you know, what is being typically given for this cancer? You know, run one arm with that and then run the other arm with your drug to show how it compares to standard of care. So I think the standard does vary a lot. I'm not sure we can make a blanket statement like that, but I do think that it is fair, you know, as you point out, that once a drug's on the market, it's actually really hard to control how it is used. So doctors often prescribe it what's called off-label, which is, you know, not for what it says on the label it's supposed to be used for. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that does compound the risk when a drug sort of goes out on the market with not a lot of information on exactly how it works or with potentially some worrying safety signs. Its impact might not be limited to the very specific population that the FDA thought it was approving it for in the first place.
We are talking about, we were talking with Caroline Chen about fast tracking with the FDA. I'm interested. I want to go back to this thing we talked about at first, Nuplazid. There was, you described a really interesting hearing that led to the approval of Nuplazid, and it wasn't as cut and dried as we have been talking about in terms of doctors saying big pharma saying we need this, and doctors in the pay of big pharma saying we need this. There are patients out there who also say that we need to fast track this drug. And I'd like you to start talking about this. You have about a minute, and then we're going to go to a break, and then we'll come back.
Yeah, so what you're describing here is the FDA's advisory committee. And so when the FDA has a drug which is sort of difficult to make a decision on, they can convene an advisory committee to help them decide. So these are outside experts. And there's a public hearing section of this where patients, doctors, sort of anybody in the public can come and sort of give testimony on whether or not they think the drug should be approved. And in the case of Nuplazid, there were a lot of patients, as you said, who came and said, please approve the drug. However, what was interesting for me to find is that actually a lot of them had been found by Acadia. So some of them actually told me, like a PR firm that had been hired by Acadia, reached out to them and said, hey, would you come to this? So there is a concern that there is a bit of bias here where the company's finding patients who are sympathetic to them to come to these hearings.
We are talking about fast-tracking drugs with Caroline Chen. She wrote a piece in ProPublica last month that talks about how big pharma is kind of influencing, not kind of, really influencing the FDA, especially when it comes to fast-tracking rare drugs. We will be back in a moment. It's The Morning Show. Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Are the FDA and pharmaceutical companies too intertwined, especially in the fast-track process? A good-faith initiative that was supposed to get experimental drugs to market is coming under fire for essentially making the approval process a sham. Caroline Chen is a healthcare reporter at ProPublica, and we are taking your calls on this, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Have you taken care of someone who had a rare disease and was maybe helped or at least given hope by a fast-track drug? Have you taken that kind of drug yourself? Have you taken an off-market drug that worked for you? Call us, 800-642-1234. Caroline, I want to go back to what we were talking about before. Like we were talking about the hearings for Nuplazid, and some of the patients were actually found by the pharmaceutical companies. But what struck me is that these patients had these harrowing stories. I mean, it pulled at your heartstrings, and then you found out later that that they were sort of recruited and paid. How much of this is being driven by emotion and not science?
Well, I think that where emotion comes in is often in the trickiest of cases, right? So I think it's easy to make a decision when a drug is obviously good, or it's easy to make a decision when the drug is obviously killing people and not doing, you know, anything at all. Those are the easy cases.
Right.
The hard cases are the rare diseases, the populations that have nothing for them. So in this case, I think a lot of the speakers, you know, even if they were recruited by Acadia, did truly believe that they were so desperate for their loved one to have something to help them, right? You know, and they, you know, there were no approved drugs available for Parkinson's disease psychosis at the time. And so there was one of the panel members who said afterwards, if there was a safe and effective alternative on the market, I would not have voted yes. But I think that in particular, the public hearing today was very compelling. There clearly is a need. So she was actually very clearly swayed by this testimony of the patients who were pleading for something, anything.
So I want to. There's a related story here, which is the right to try legislation. That's a bill that was passed in May that made it legal for terminally ill patients to try experimental drugs that the FDA hasn't even approved. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so I do want to clear up one misconception that I hear a lot about right to try, which is that it gives patients the right to ask drug makers directly for the drugs, but it doesn't actually compel the drug makers to give the drugs to them.
Hmm.
So I actually don't know how much right to try is going to change things for patients, because traditionally, if you were in a terminal situation and you tried everything on the market, your doctor could go to the FDA and ask the FDA to clear you taking an experimental drug that had not yet been approved. So that pathway actually already did exist. And what right to try has basically done is cut out the FDA and let the patient go directly to the pharma company. But pharma companies can still say no.
And why would they?
Pardon?
Why would they? Because they may be sued or?
Oh, well, exactly. That's the problem. Like, what if they give a patient a drug and it kills them, you know, and they get a lot of bad press for that? Or the FDA says, wow, you got to stop all the trials that you're doing right now because now we're worried that this drug, you know, has some terrible side effect. It can really affect a drug maker's ongoing, you know, development program for the drug. So I think they tend to be quite cautious about giving drugs to patients when they haven't been approved.
So we started off this program listening to a clip from the Dallas Buyers Club, which is about gay men having to go to Mexico to get AIDS drugs. Is that still a market, going to Mexico or going to Canada to get drugs that have been approved but haven't been approved here?
So I think at this point, the U.S. usually is the leader in approving drugs. Mm. So for the most part, drugs will be approved in the U.S. before they are elsewhere. So I think that sort of, you know, it's called medical tourism sometimes,
right,
tends to happen less for reasons of I can't get the drug. However, people are traveling overseas because it's cheaper overseas. And that definitely still happens.
Interesting. And I'm hearing you get good dental. People go to Mexico to go to the dentist.
Yeah, I think people just go where their wallets drive them if they can't pay in the U.S.
So, here's the question, though. What is the average consumer supposed to do about this? If I go to a doctor or I take my mother to a doctor and that doctor says, okay, I'm going to give you this drug, how do I know that that drug is safe? How do I know that that doctor is being paid by the pharmaceutical companies or is being visited by and is friends with a pharmaceutical rep? How do I know all this stuff?
Yeah, I think this is a really great question for you to ask, because I think there are, as we've talked about today, arguments on both sides for whether the FDA should lower the bar in some cases or speed things in some cases. So ultimately, as a consumer, you have no control over that. And so I think what you want to do when you go into the doctor is ask questions. I think you should always ask the doctor, hey, can you actually talk me through the risks and the benefits of this drug? How many trials was this drug approved based on? How many patients were in that trial? There's some drugs that get approved on very, very small patient populations. That's useful to know.
So what is the average? What's the patient population I should be looking for?
Well, it depends on the drug. If it's a rarer disease, you're not going to have as many patients. If it's a disease that many people have and they say, well, oh, it was approved on, you know, 50 patients, you might say, wow, that's not a lot of information, you know, there.
Right.
And I think that you should ask about, you know, what side effects did they see in the trials? And all of this information is actually usually available to find either on the drug's label, which is long and dense, but I would say go to the clinical trials section, which is usually buried somewhere in the middle, and read that part because it shows you what was found in the clinical trials.
Hmm.
In terms of whether or not the doctors have relationships with pharma, as I mentioned, ProPublica has, this is freely available. If you go to our website and you look up Dollars for Docs, we do have an online searchable database where you can put in your doctor's name and find out, you know, how much they get paid from pharma. So that's also available information online. And I think you can always ask the doctor. You can also say, one thing I think that is always useful for a patient to say is, why this drug? Are there other options? Because understandably, even doctors get distracted by shiny new things.
Mm-hmm.
And they can say, oh, this is a new drug. We know this is really exciting. But there are some advocates who advise patients to be slow on the new drugs as they're coming to market and as issues are being worked out or as doctors are getting to know them. You can always ask, are there other alternatives? Why is this better than, say, a generic alternative that's already on the market? So I think the more information you have as a patient, the more empowered you are to be able to make a good decision.
Patients are also swayed by shiny new things, and that comes in the form of advertising. And I have seen things advertised recently that are for rare conditions, and I'm wondering why they have these ads on the air.
But they have these ads on the air because they work.
And patients come in and say, I have this condition. There was one that was for a vaccine for meningitis. It was on recently, and it caught my eye only because it was like, you love your kid, you take care of your kid, and then you send him off to college, and he's gonna die when he goes to college by getting meningitis. I was like, oh my God! And it's rare actually to get meningitis. So like, where does that come from? And how does it get past sort of the censors? Are there any censors? And why does it work?
I definitely think a lot of these ads can be quite scary. The FDA is also in charge of making sure that drug companies don't overstep their bounds. You know, you're not allowed to, say, advertise for, a different type of cancer than the drug actually had been approved for. Or if you have a Parkinson's drug, you can't advertise for using it in Alzheimer's patients, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So they do have some parameters for the drug companies, and they are monitored in that way. But as you said, they can be very scary. They can be very emotional. Then they give you the side effects sort of in like a really quick blurb at the end.
Right.
So they sort of all run together and you can't really listen to them. But I think when you see an ad and you're interested in it, again, I would say, talk to your doctor, ask them, what did the clinical trials actually show? What are the risks there? And in terms of things like vaccinations, a great place to go is to the CDC, because the CDC does put out recommendations for what is actually necessary. So I think that there are other places you can go other than the ad to try and get more information about what is actually right for you.
Should we just figure out what Canada has approved and go by that?
I have not done an in-depth look at Canada. So I'm hesitant to advise that without fully understanding, you know, what Canada has approved. But I do think that that's maybe another smart thing to do, is to say, hey, was this approved in Europe? And you can always look that up or ask your doctor and see whether or not, are there cases where, you know, Europe is turning down this drug, saying that there's not enough information on its benefit. Maybe that would give you pause. Ultimately, I do think that the decision is really each patient's, because some patients have a higher risk tolerance than others. But I think my biggest concern, as I reported the story, is that patients should have the information. They should know how much uncertainty that they're getting.
So we started out talking about the fact that this has become more of a partnership with the FDA and Big Pharma rather than an oversight. Is there anything that you're hearing from legislators or leaders in any way saying, maybe we should pull this back and have a separate oversight arm?
So far, I haven't really. And I think that it's understandable to some degree, because Congress the most often hears from the desperate patients, right? Mm. Like, if you're a Congress member and you have someone saying to you, saying, I'm dying of this disease and I just want access to this drug, you know, or FDA is taking forever to approve this drug, that emotional appeal is really powerful. And I think that's sort of why we've had this trend, is because even Congress sort of has been very influenced to want to give things to patients faster. And I think that I can understand that we all want to help patients sooner. I think the question is just, what is the trade-off? And I think one of the most striking things I heard in all of my interviewing was talking to a former HIV activist who had actually lobbied for the FDA to move faster and faster. And he's now a Yale professor. And he really worries that we've gone too far. And he said, you know, at the time we were desperate, but he said 30 years of our rash thinking has led us to a place where we know less and less about the drugs we pay more and more for.
We have been talking to Caroline Shen. She's a healthcare reporter at ProPublica, and she wrote a piece about the relationship between pharma companies and the Food and Drug Administration. It's called FDA Repays Industry by Rushing Risky Drugs to Market. Caroline Shen, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's the morning show. You're listening to the Ideas Network, and I'm Carrie Kaufman.